Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David Latulippe. This week I'll be talking with Charles Slender-White, founder and artistic director of FACT, SF, about the world premiere of Death, an immersive dance performance about the loss of a loved one. From the African-American Shakespeare Company, we'll meet with actresses Natasha Legrone and Jan Hunter, who play roles in the theater piece for colored girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough. First time in more than 20 years that this much-revered Tony-nominated and Obie-winning play from 1976 is being produced in the Bay Area. I'll talk to choreographer Sid Perlman about her The All Joan Show, a retrospective that celebrates her longstanding collaboration with renowned San Francisco-based cellist and composer Joan Jean-Renaud, who will also be in the studio. And I'll talk with Smuin Ballet's artistic director Celia Fuchil about the company's 25th anniversary season, which opens tomorrow at the Lesher Center for the Arts in Walnut Creek, and next end of this month and early next at the Palace of Fine Arts here in San Francisco. Stay with us here on Open Air. This fall, Sid Perlman Performance will present the All Joan Show, a retrospective of dances made in collaboration with renowned San Francisco-based cellist and composer Joan Jean-Renaud. It runs the 21st and 22nd at the Joe Good Annex in San Francisco before moving to Santa Cruz for three-evening engagement at Motion Pacific, October 19th to the 21st. Inspired by the resilience, fragility, and resourcefulness of the human body, Sid Perlman makes dances about how we negotiate being together in a complex world. Her most recent collaborations have been with composers Joan Jean-Renaud and with Jonathan Siegel of Camper Van Beethoven. Among other honors, Sid was a Fulbright Scholar in 2009 and 10 and choreographed and taught in Estonia. She currently teaches in the Theater Arts Department at UC Santa Cruz and the Dance Department at Cabrillo College. Sid, a pleasure to welcome you back to our airwaves.
Thanks, David. It's great to be here.
Of course, and always a pleasure to talk with Joan Jean-Renaud. She is a Memphis, Tennessee native, so I was exposed to all kinds of music growing up, the blues, Elvis, soul, and classical music. She learned some jazz with David Baker, Joe Henderson, toured with the Kronos Quartet for some 20 years, and for the last 20 years, she's been involved with solo and collaborative projects in composition, improvisation, electronics, and multidisciplinary performances. Over 80 compositions for cello, small ensembles, and multimedia. Her CD, Strange Toys, was nominated for a 2008 Grammy, and her latest recording, Visual Music, appears on her own label, Deconet Records. Joan, such a pleasure to welcome you back to our airwaves.
It's great to see you again.
Sid, how can we not celebrate Joan, and how wonderful of you to do a full evening retrospective of some of her works.
Absolutely agreed. I think the collaborations that Joan and I have worked on together have been some of my most rewarding as collaborations, and also the output in terms of the choreographies. So to bring these back to the stage and have a chance to revisit them with new dancers has been just a wonderful opportunity. And then for us to get to spend some time and work together again is always great.
Mm-hmm. So take us back. When did you guys first collaborate?
When did we first collaborate? 2004.
2004, I do believe.
So for Strange Toys, and I was living in Los Angeles, though I'd had a company here for a bunch of years before that, and Joan and I knew each other socially. And at some point, I was like, hey, Joan, want to collaborate? And she said,
of course.
Of course, yeah. And so I was interested in a sort of a short format. And so the piece, the dance is 5 2-minute dances. And then what ended up on Strange Toys, Joan's album, CD, is 6 pieces. And
it was really actually so interesting always working with Sid, because she always gives me these ideas that I wouldn't necessarily come up with on my own. And Strange Toys is a perfect example, because I was sort of like, oh, well, what do you want, Sid? And she mentioned this idea of just making 2-minute pieces, 5 2-minute pieces, so comes 10-minute piece, of course, and it was like, oh, that sounds really cool. And it was interesting how you'd think that'd be really easy, but it was harder than I thought. But in the long run, it worked out great. And at that time, I was using my looper a lot. And so I was able to perform these pieces live with the looper and with Sid and the two dancers.
For the uninitiated, explain what a looper is.
A looper is. Okay. Well, a looper.
Inside baseball, I get it.
Basically, a loop is a loop. You know, it's just something that repeats over and over. And if you have an electronic device that, you know, you can press a button to start your loop, and then press a button to stop it, and then it'll just keep looping.
And so you can layer over all sorts of things.
Exactly. So my looper was the kind where I could keep adding layers. Unfortunately, if I subtracted them, I had to go back one at a time. So you had some restrictions by using this looper, but in a sense, you know, sometimes restrictions can be actually creative, and you come up with really different ideas of how to use it.
Well, you also have to have some metronomic timing, too. It's got to be pretty precise.
This is very true.
Well, let's hear a little bit of music for Strange Toys, and then we'll talk a little bit more.
Sounds good.
From Music for Strange Toys, you heard cellist Joan John Renault. Cellist Joan John Renault.
Said very well. It's hard name to pronounce.
Over and over again. That was all you, wasn't it?
It's a loop.
Not loopy sounding at all. A fascinating sound. It's an interesting building up of sounds that it's just very, very creative. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And I wanted to thank you again for having us here. Public radio is such an important place to hear music, be exposed to culture, talk about big ideas in a small context. So I want to thank you for the work that you do in having us here.
Thank you, Sid Perlman, and Joan for coming in, of course. The number to call to support KLW during this, our final couple days of our membership campaign, is 800-525-9917. Did you hear something on Open Air that piqued your interest, perhaps made you become an audience member of something that you heard on Open Air, or just exposed your ears to something you wouldn't ordinarily hear on your Thursday afternoon? Well, we hope that is worth supporting in a financial way, as more than 68% of our operating budget comes from individual listeners that come forward and support this local public radio station. You can do that by calling 800-525-9917 or going online to KALW.org. Sid Perlman Performance presents the All Joan Show at the Joe Good Annex tomorrow and Saturday, and at Motion Pacific in Santa Cruz in October. So tell us a little bit about the collaboration with poetry, Sid.
We did a piece called Your Body Is Not a Shark, which premiered in 2013 at ODC Theater. It was a collaboration between me, Joan, and a wonderful poet, Denise Lido, who I'd met at a Geraci residency a few years before that. And this piece really looked at the possibilities inherent within limitation. Denise has laryngeal dystonia, Joan has MS, and we were thinking about the stumble and the stutter as a central metaphor and ways to interrupt our processes. So, for example, Denise wrote us 9 poetic structures, gave us an explanatory text, and I used the poetic structure to interrupt my choreography as well and to help me go out in new directions. And I think it was a really interesting process and very dense, complicated, and I think in the end really rewarding.
It was great for me to work with Denise because I had never worked directly with a poet before. And she really has a fascinating voice, in my opinion. And it's like me, I have a fascinating walk. It's not the normal walk. But, you know, you start to realize, wow, she had so much to say and so many great ideas. And it was really interesting for me to take text of her talking and speaking her poems at times also, and then be able to do sort of collages with that. So it was like using her words and using her voice and then using the cello in addition to that too, but it just creates a much larger sort of picture, mm-hmm. You know?
How did the title Your Body Is Not a Shark come to be?
When Denise and I first spoke about doing a collaboration, she gave me some of the poems that she'd been writing, and this one line really struck with me, especially as we're sort of thinking about bodies and vulnerability and strength and how things shift and change. So the shark seemed like a great metaphor. We've had this question asked a lot. It's, you know, I don't think it's a if you sink if you don't keep moving kind of a metaphor, but more sort of a sense of both the fragility and the toughness of the human body.
Well, I think Joan can speak of that certain toughness that you've got to you've got to persevere. I know you've been struggling with MS, and your creative output is still so tremendous. I mean,
well, it's interesting how sometimes those kind of restrictions can actually give you a lot of inspiration. And so, you know, I was always a cellist. I never thought of myself as a composer until, you know, I got MS and then couldn't really tour very much anymore. It was just too difficult. So it's like, okay, well, what can I do? And so then I turned to composing, and it just became a really wonderful thing for me to be able to do. And I always thought of, you know, the title, Your Body Is Not a Shark, also in relationship to like, well, you can't be afraid of your body. Your body is what it is. You have to accept it to a certain extent, and then you kind of move on and do what you can with it. And, you know, that's all what all of us do, I think, in life, is you do the best you can.
Right. Well, your resilience is truly exemplary.
Well, thank you.
Fantastic. We are going to hear some music from Your Body Is Not a Shark. Tell us a little bit about the music.
So this is, you'll hear Denise and her poetry, and you'll just hear how I've integrated her voice with sound effects. And again, this was an opportunity that Sid gave me that sort of broadened my scope of composition. So it became much more like a sound collage in a certain sense than a... Well, I mean, it is still a formal piece of music, I suppose, but it's not, your ABA form in classical music or something.
Well, let's have a listen to that. Not before I say thank you so much for coming in and wish you wonderful performances of the All Joan Show once again tomorrow and Saturday at the Joe Good Annex, October 19th to the 21st at Motion Pacific in Santa Cruz. More information for the San Francisco performances are at joegood.org/box office. If you want to see what's going on in Sid's life, go to sidperlman.org. That's sidperlman.org. We'll have links to both my guests' websites at our website at the open air page at KLW. Thanks again for coming in.
This line is in order. it will disappear just as you're messing. The body, which is the brain, aquatic striation. When your body is not a shark, what am I might look like in my brain?
Every mechanism neurologically.
A shark of my it could rip my throat out of
the world.
Eating.
This is clear the evolution of your relationship to your body.
Speech is a code for speech. Each body is its own.
It's clear the evolution of your relationship to your body.
I don't know who I am anymore, and that undermine my confidence moving through the world, and then to have the world reflect back, not always, of course, but in a certain way,
is not
immortal. Then there's this that it will disappear just as
I find my voice again,
but it's always different.
You're being
body, which is
quiet.
Aquatic striation.
It's really interesting that
when your body
sounds in utterance, how you see yourself,
what from my look like sound and my swaying limbs and
every mechanism neurologically
a shark in
from your body is not a shark, a collaboration between Joan, Jean Renaud, and Sid Perlman. Again, links to their performances are at our website, kalw.org, this weekend here in San Francisco in October in Santa Cruz. On the occasion of its 10th anniversary, Fact SF is proud to announce the world premiere of Death, an immersive performance about the experience of losing a loved one. It's co-presented by Counterpulse, where it's being staged Thursdays through Saturdays, September 27th through October 13th. Joining me to talk about the production is Fact SF's founder, my guest Charles Slender White, who is one of 32 counter technique teachers worldwide, a technique we'll talk about shortly. He's a Cal grad where he studied dance and English literature with early training at Berklee Ballet Theater and the American Dance Festival. Welcome to you, Charles.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Of course. Happy to have you. He's joined by Gene Pfeffer, an artist and arts producer, as well as director of producing and advancement at Counterpulse, the premier San Francisco venue for innovative, risk-taking performance and multimedia arts. She now serves as president of the Fact SF Board of Directors and shepherded the company through its tour of Russia and through its launch of the company as well. Gene co-produced this production of Death. Gene, a very happy welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Well, this is something we can all relate to, and we're all going to have to deal with at some point.
Yes.
So tell me your perspective of why did you want to do something like this in the way that you're doing it?
For the project for Death, right? I felt like I was finally ready in terms of my craft to tackle such a big topic. Death is something that has always been a part of my life. My mother died when I was 8 months old, and so my family was already in a state of grief as soon as I came into the world. And And I think death, because it's so common and so ubiquitous, and grief is something that everyone either has experienced or will experience, I thought that it could be both a place for myself and for my collaborators to investigate the complexity and the potential catharsis of the topic, and to provide a place for the audience to share the experience with us.
This is an immersive, being built as an immersive experience. You're limiting the number of people to 40 per performance, and they're going to be moving around a little bit. You're utilizing both spaces up and down of the counterpulse space. What will people see in each of those spaces?
So the audience will come in and sit on the risers as they typically would in a traditional show at Counterpulse. And then one by one, the audience members will be guided down into the basement, where they will have a one-on-one performance with a performer in the basement. From there, they'll be guided back onto the stage, where they'll be reseated in the round. So we've actually created three separate performance spaces, and a combination of more communally oriented viewing and one-on-one individualized viewing.
Jean, tell us a little bit about the challenges presented in this way of presenting.
Yeah, so, you know, Counterpulse moved into a new 10,000 square foot facility in 2016, located at 80 Turk Street in the Tenderloin. And with that move, you know, we tripled our square footage and sort of, you know, exponentially improved our impact for artists and what we can offer them. And so Charles was one of the first artists, I think, to use the full space, like really install a performance in the theater. And this was the Roma project that happened a couple of years ago, another co-production that we did with him at Counterpulse. And so we've had the pleasure of really breaking in the space in partnership with artists like Charles to get a handle on, yeah, how do we produce this really elaborate full-scale dance and theater production between spaces, between floors? How does that work for access? All these different considerations. And the great thing about Counterpulse is just how fully we embrace iteration and process. And we center ourselves around the artists and their vision, and really do everything we can to support that vision, you know, within our capacity and the law and things like that.
Always good to keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Especially in that area of the Tenderloin. Yeah. Charles, I mentioned this counter technique of that you're one of 32 teachers.
That's right, yeah.
What is counter technique?
Counter technique is a contemporary dance technique. It was developed by Anouk van Dijk, who's a Dutch choreographer, and she worked on it throughout her career, and it really sort of took form in 2003. And it's a contemporary dance technique that allows dancers to work in a more spatially oriented manner and to change direction more quickly, and to do all of that while reducing the likelihood of damage and injury on their bodies. So it helps dancers, I think, engage with the space around them in a more interesting way and also have longer careers.
Mm. All of these dancers then involved in this production are counter technique versed.
Right. So FACTSF uses counter technique as our regular training system. So at the beginning of rehearsal, we always have company class. There are two counter technique trained companies in the world right now. FACTSF is one of them. The other is Chunky Move in Melbourne. And counter technique for us both provides a very efficient and comprehensive way of getting warm, but also a way of integrating our intellectual processes into our physical action. So that's a major part of counter technique, and it's also a major part of FACTSF's work, that all of the artists are movers and thinkers.
I should have started earlier on and asked you, how did you come up with the, is FACTSF an acronym? It's all capital letters, FACT/SF.
Yeah, FACTSF is an acronym, and I founded the company when I was 24, and at the time my last name was Charles Slender, and I knew that I couldn't have Slender Dance Company. It's quite in vogue for people to just name last name dance company.
And then body shaming and that for those that
are. Well, then I either have slender. To have a intentionally diverse cast of different shapes and sizes or only skinny dancers. And I wasn't ready to commit to either of those. And now that my last name is Slender White, it's even worse. So I created FACTSF because I was always interested in the shift between the factual and the fictional. So FACT is an acronym for Fictional Artists Contemporary Theater.
Oh, okay.
With the idea that art making and life making are in some ways acts of fiction making, or we could say also a part of the creative process.
Mm-hmm. Gene Pfeffer, you helped Fact SF in their first tour of Russia.
Yes.
That must have been an interesting experience.
Yeah, that is the least of it interesting, I think. It was incredible. We were there under the auspices of the U.S. State Department. We did a 8-city tour.
We did 9 cities.
9 cities, yeah. 7 performances, mm-hmm. though. Yeah. We started in Vladivostok on the east coast of Russia and traveled the Trans-Siberian, sort of the backwards way you might do it, through, you know, the Urals and all the way up through Moscow and St. Petersburg. It is an incredibly diverse country, like appetites for the arts and just the geography itself, very, very beautiful in that way, really vast. By and large, you know, like in America, contemporary dance audiences are not super huge, but they are excited and supportive, and they definitely turned out for us. More so when we got further west, I would say. Yeah. We had a couple of rough shows at the beginning, but things improved once we got past the Urals, by and large.
Interesting. All right.
Yeah.
I'll wait for the video on that one, I guess. Well, this fall, you'll tour 4 countries in Eastern Europe, and Sofia, Bulgaria, and Belgrade, Serbia. The company will perform Disintegration from 2016. Tell us more about the tour that's coming out October 24th to November 17th.
It's in some ways quite a dream come true, much like the Russian tour was. I started my career working in Russia and continued those relationships with my colleagues there until 2012 when we got to go back. And 2015 was the beginning of another set of relationships when I went back. I went to Serbia and Bulgaria for research that was actually facilitated by funds through Counterpulse for the project Disintegration. So we are starting in Bulgaria and then going to Serbia. Disintegration is a project about the Roma diaspora and about my family's own experiences, Roma Americans who had chose to integrate into traditional sort of standard white American society, and what it means to be able to pass in society depending on the tone of your skin and how you get coded as belonging to different groups. And so we premiered that work, Disintegration, in 2016 as a co-production again with Counterpulse. In 2017, we made a duet called Platform, and so we're touring Platform to Croatia and to Macedonia. And I would say, in addition to performing the works, which of course is the centerpiece of the tour, we're also facilitating embodied storytelling workshops with youth, who both Roma youth and non-Roma youth, as a way to help them bridge their own cross-cultural connections within each of the different countries. And much like our Russian tour, this is, again, supported by the State Department.
Fantastic. That should be exciting.
Yeah.
Looking forward to that, I'm sure. Well, let's back up a little bit about the dancers that are involved in Death. Tell us about your company.
So since 2012 was the when I cast the bulk of the folks who are still working with me, there are 9 performers in total, including myself. 5 of them are company members, and 3 of them are guests who are just coming in for this project. We have a nice age range of performers from 20, I think 23 is our youngest, all the way up to 43, which for me brings with it a whole different range of experiences and impulses, which is really nice when I'm in the creative process. Some dancers want to go faster or slower or be more thoughtful or more instinctual. And having this diversity amongst the group of people creates a really, really rich environment for me to play in.
Impulses, and we should say counterpulses, for that matter, right?
Absolutely.
The work Death is being performed at the at Counterpulse on Turk Street.
Turk Street.
The performances again.
We open on September 27th, which is next Thursday. We run Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 8 p.m. from September 27th through October 13th.
3-week run.
Yeah, we have a 3-week run. And we decided to do a 3-week run in celebration of our 10-year anniversary. And there's a lot of labor that goes into creating an evening-length work. And in dance, it's often sad that you spend all this time and money creating something, and then it goes up for 2 nights and it disappears.
Yeah.
So...
We didn't talk much about the music that's being involved. I know that we're going to hear some Mozart, the Lacrimosa from the Requiem. What other music are you using throughout the evening?
The rest of the music is pre-recorded music. We have not commissioned original music for this show. There's a variety of orchestral music and electronic music and a set of ambient sounds that we'll play without that plays with different pitches and vibrations. And the Lacrimosa itself is not just a really beautiful piece of music, but also one that gets at grief and death and weeping like right away.
Mm. Let's hear the music of Mozart as we say thank you and goodbye to Charles Slender-White and Gene Pfeffer. Wish you wonderful performances. More information about the performances are at counterpulse.org. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cremosa from Mozart's Requiem, some of the music that will be used in the FACT SF world premiere of Death, an immersive performance about the experience of losing a loved one, being presented at Counterpulse on Turk Street in San Francisco. Information at counterpulse.org. A very good afternoon to you once again. I'm David LaTulipe. Still to come, you'll hear about the African-American Shakespeare Company presentation of For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. But briefly, a commercial announcement for non-commercial radio, KALW. We are in our fall membership campaign, final days of which we need to ramp up to go out on a strong note. We're encouraging you to call 800-525-9917 or go to kalw.org for more information about some of the many thank you gifts we can offer you. But the important thing is to step up. Step up for KALW, for the arts programming that we offer, for the news and information that you come to depend on. Perhaps you're a new listener to this radio station, 91.7, or online at klw.org. Well, now's the time to support it. Over 68% of our budget is listeners funded. And then when it comes down to it, looking at our budget, over 78% of that budget goes directly into acquiring and developing the programming that you've come to love here on KLW. During our next segment, please, 800-525-9917, and show your support for the arts on KLW. My next guest, Celia Fuchiel, has been leading the artistic vision of Smuin Ballet for many years and has increased its reputation as San Francisco's premier company of contemporary American ballet. She's a founding member of Michael Smuin's company, was its principal dancer for more than 12 years. I talked with her the other day. Let's hear that conversation now and some of the music involved in their upcoming 25th anniversary performances. Celia, such a pleasure to welcome you back to our open airwaves.
Thank you, David. Great to be here again.
Lots of exciting things to talk about in this, the 25th anniversary season of Smuin Contemporary Dance.
It is hard to believe.
So first, let's see how did you assemble this program to start things off?
I've curated this whole season of 18-19 to reflect on our foundation, celebrate our roots, and look ahead to the future of what contemporary ballet is and what we're doing with this incredible art form.
So you're incorporating into this special anniversary season some works from the Contemporary Showcase. Tell us a little bit about that program.
Right. After Michael Smuin, our founder, passed away in 2007, we implemented a choreography showcase at Smuin. And every year or two, when our budget allows, we have a series of performances and designate 3 weeks of rehearsal for the dancers where they have an opportunity to create on one another. And it's a really important process for the dancers to be exposed to, because you don't just wake up one day and know how to choreograph. It's a process learning how to craft dances. And so I'm delighted to be able to bring three of those works that had their genesis at the choreography showcase to the main stage. And so one of the pieces is by a now former dancer of Smuin, Rex Wheeler, and two of my current dancers, Nicole Haskins and Ben Needham Wood, are also contributing. And interestingly enough, I was drawn to these three works not only because of their strength, but because they also focus in areas in which genres Michael liked to create in. One selected classical music, the other is a narrative, and the third is to pop music. And so these were three areas that really also attracted Michael. And so in many ways, we continue to keep his spirit alive by the works in which we present.
I'm always curious about the music that's being chosen. So these younger choreographers, you mentioned there's some classical music being involved. What is the music that that person's using?
Rex is using a Boris Tchaikovsky selection. It is from the Sinfonietta for String Orchestra.
Very nice. He's
named his piece Sinfonietta.
Uh-huh. Makes sense. And of course, we have to pay tribute to Michael Smuin, who founded the company some 25 years ago, right? And you're bringing back his Schubert Scherzo.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the story of when that was originally supposed to be done, the story of the piece.
Well, it was around 2000, 2001, that Michael had received a very generous grant from the Carol Buck Foundation. And he had intended to use the Schubert Scherzo at that time, just that movement of the symphony. And then 9/11 happened, and Michael was not in such a joyous mood. And so he contacted Carol, and he said, would it be all right if I changed my music? And she said, of course, change your music. You must do what you feel compelled to do. And at that point, he created his glorious Stabat Mater, which was his reflection on 9/11 about hope in the face of such loss. And he used the Dvorak Stabat Mater. And so many years later, unbeknownst to us that this would be his final work, he was in a very much happier place and decided to turn back to the Schubert Scherzo. And so in 2007, he created this ballet, which ultimately was his final work.
Wow.
He never saw it performed. And so it felt appropriate that we would do the work in this celebratory season and kick it off with Michael's final ballet and also his Eternal Idol, which is another work of his that next year will be 50 years old.
50 years old.
The Eternal Idol, he created it at American Ballet Theater for Cynthia Gregory and Yvonne Nagy. Hmm. And so there's a lot of history behind that piece, and that's to the glorious second movement of the Chopin Piano Concerto in F.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be an exciting season to bring all of these things together.
And you're welcoming a number of new dancers into the company this year?
We do. We have quite a few new dancers. Some of our veterans retired last year or went off to other adventures. And I'm just delighted with this new group of dancers that has so quickly assimilated into the group.
Well, it's going to be an exciting time for them because for a number of years, Smuin has sort of been a, I don't want to say dog and pony show, but you've been a sort of vagabonds in terms of space. And now if you have a chance, or if you read the August 19th Pink Pages, you read Sam Whiting's incredible article, a front page article, and then a fine feature that featured in one of the photos lovely Celia Fuchiel in a bedazzled hard hat. So tell us a little bit about the other exciting news for Smuin this year.
It is very, very exciting for us. As you mentioned, David, we've never had our own space, which we would control the schedule of, and we have now identified a building for Smuin, and hopefully by mid-year next year, at the conclusion of our 25th season, the remodeling will be complete, and we'll have a permanent home with two studios, and it will be for our rehearsals and to be able to begin some expanding some programs with our outreach, offering classes, and really it will be a game changer for Smuin.
Sure. We look forward to seeing that space and to seeing the dancers there as well once the building is finished in its renovation. One of the other things I learned in the Sam Whiting article in the Chronicle was that you were the first Santa baby for the Christmas show.
I was.
For those that haven't seen that amazing show, tell us a little bit about the number Santa Baby and what was it like doing it for the very first time?
There are only a couple of works in Michael's Christmas Ballet that have been done every single year because some things come and go. So the way the Christmas Ballet is arranged, the first act is called the Classical Christmas and everything is in a beautiful white. The second act, we switch gears into the Cool Christmas and everything is in red. And it's wonderful because every year we add new dances in, we take out old dances, we bring back things that haven't been danced in a number of years, and a lot of it depends on the cast of dancers. So with new dancers coming this year, we'll have some changes, of course, from last year. But our publicist actually recommended Santa Baby, the Eartha Kitt version, to Michael, and so he created a dance for me. And the first year of the Christmas Ballet was 1995, and I had only been in rehearsal day after day after day, and yet the first day I stepped on the stage at Yerba Buena to perform that, before I walked to center stage with my 42-foot-long boa,
that's the feature.
I realized I had the audience right in my hand because having not done it in front of an audience before, I could not have precisely anticipated the reaction, and it was just fantastic, and it's it brings that response every year, so yeah. It's great fun.
The 42-foot boa and the Eartha Kitt music singing Santa Baby, it is a classic, and for many years to come, it's wonderful to hear that you were the first one. And that'll be in, of course, the December Christmas show for Smuin. In the meantime, Smuin Dance Series number 1 gets underway the 21st and 2nd in Walnut Creek, and then September 28th to this October 6th here in San Francisco at the Palace of Fine Arts. SmuinBallet.org for more information. Let's hear some of that marvelous Schubert scherzo to go out with. Celia Fuchiel, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, David. We'll be right back.
Wonderful scherzo from Schubert's Symphony No. 9, The Great. Music that you'll hear as part of the Smuin Ballet's epic 25th anniversary season, and as they complete a work on their brand new permanent space. Congratulations to Celia Fuschiel and the company of Smuin. SmuinBallet.org for more information. For the first time in over 20 years, the Bay Area will have the chance to experience Entozake Shange's For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough. It's a riveting evening of provocative dance, music, and poetry that tells the story of seven individual women dealing with the at times brutal, tender, and dramatic arcs of their lives. Shange titled the characters Lady in Brown, Lady in Purple, Lady in Blue, Lady in Red, Lady in Orange, Lady in Green, and Lady in Yellow. I'm pleased to welcome Blue and Brown to the KLW airwaves. Natasha Legrone plays the Lady in Blue. She's making her debut with the African American Shakespeare Company and comes from Flint, Michigan, where she is an alumna of Michigan State University. And here at ACT, she was at ACT for a San Francisco semester. She's been seen recently in productions with San Francisco Bay Area Theater Company, BATCO, including I, Too, Sing America, How to Be a White Man, and La Posarella. Natasha has been performing with ACT in The Taming of the Shrew, Every 28 Hours in The Insurgents. She was also spotted in the summer 2018 feature film, Sorry to Bother You. Natasha, welcome to our airwaves.
Thank you so much for having me.
Happy to have you. And the Lady in Brown is none other than Jan Hunter, who makes her return to the African American Shakespeare Company stage, having previously performed in productions of Oedipus, The School for Scandal, Pygmalion, and most recently in A Streetcar Named Desire. She also performed with the Lorraine Hainsbury Theater in their heyday. Jan was born and raised in Los Angeles and was one of the original Soul Train dancers. We'll have to talk about that. She received degrees in drama and in education, and she's a newly retired theater educator, was director of the Performing Arts Academy at Skyline High School for some 24 years, directing and producing some 4 shows a year. Mm. Welcome to retirement. I'm sure you're taking a nice long breath, not worrying about bells or whistles or getting up early, I hope.
Yes. I'm loving it.
We should mention that this production of Four Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow is Enough is running at the Taube Atrium Theater as part of the, I guess we call that the San Francisco Opera Annex now, that beautiful new space up there.
Beautiful space.
And it runs through the 29th. I need to talk to you first about the title. This is a 20-year-old work. Was this...
No, it's much older than that.
Okay. First time in 20 years it's being presented.
It's been here in the Bay Area. But it won the Joseph Papp Shakespeare Award in 1976. And it was all the buzz. And it has been done across the country, around the world, I'm sure. It's been a while since it was done here in the Bay Area.
Well, it's a very provocative title.
Yes.
Is that a thing? Was that a thing? Is that still a thing in terms of the way the title is phrased for colored girls who considered suicide?
It does catch your attention, doesn't it?
It does. So how does that figure into the genesis of the work?
because the play deals with very specific, traumatic and passionate and loving and supportive, but also the drama of life that women in general experience. These seven women just represent some of the experiences that women go through. So I believe that Intozaki in the 70s was expressing her feelings about situations and in dance and in song and in poetry, where she wove a story together, letting women have a voice about their challenges. And it's very relevant today.
Were you familiar with the work when it first came out?
Yes, I was. I actually did the play in 1978 in Houston when they had the first International Women's Year conference with Rosalind Carter. President Carter's wife came.
Wow.
And it was a real big deal in Houston, and I was blessed to be in that cast back in 78.
Tell us a little bit about the character Lady in Brown. What are her struggles and pitfalls that she goes through?
Well, Lady in Brown has a few pieces. One of her pieces brings the play together in the beginning, basically asking our audience to look at the struggles of women, look at their caring struggles, and give them the opportunity to sing their songs of life, sing a righteous gospel about them, that oftentimes women are looked at, you know, time downtrodden, and she's saying, hear their stories, hear their song, and let's come together, let's lift them up. And I think that's what's really important about the opening piece as well as the closing.
Jan Hunter, who's playing the Lady in Brown in For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. Also joined by Natasha Lagrone as the Lady in Blue. Before we talk the specifics about your character, mm-hmm. is this the first time that you were familiar with this work?
No, actually. Okay. When I was in college, I studied communication and always had a desire to study theater. So I was able to get my feet wet in high school and then come back to my pursuit of theater a little bit throughout college. However, I would always go online and look up For Colored Girls. There was a PBS special done with actors I admire so much, such as Alfre Woodard as well as Lynn Whitfield. And I would go back and look at their performances. And this was probably about 2009. So this is a story I've been familiar with probably for the last decade. And even Tyler Perry, you know, he did a movie based on this work. Mm-hmm. And so we saw it go from the stage to the screen, actually. Although, you know, this is the original work, this play and this production, but I was familiar with that story by seeing screen versions. And now to be able to do it on the stage in its original context has just been amazing.
Mm-hmm. We should give a shout out to the other colors in the
yes,
other ladies
yes,
in color
yes.
That are also involved. The Lady in Purple is played by Bobby Kindred.
Yes.
The Lady in Red, Paige Mays.
Yes.
In Orange, Regina Monique. In Green, Brittany Nicole Sims. And mm-hmm. Lady in Yellow is Tiffany Tenniel.
Yes.
So tell us, either one of you, Natasha, maybe you can start with this. Mm-hmm. What is director Elizabeth Carter brought to the equation?
Oh, my. What hasn't she brought to the equation is the question. I would just even relate to Lady in Brown's line that she talks about at the end of her opening monologue. She talks about these women being handled warmly.
Yes.
And that is what Elizabeth Carter has done with us as an ensemble, as a cast, as an actor, as a human, as a storyteller, because she is also an actor who is a director playing that hat in this room, but she comes from a first-person experience knowing what it is to be an actor. So she was able to, like, direct us in a way that was very warm and generous, pushing us, giving us what we needed, but then two, allowing us to grow and allowing us to be challenged throughout this journey. So she really allowed for us to take the work and have a lot of freedom and gave us an opportunity to have our own interpretations, but also like just the dramaturgy that went into the process during our table read from day one.
Yes.
We were able to really dissect the words of this beautiful writing and really see what this story means and how we can honor the stories and the lives of these women in the story that we're telling.
Mm-hmm. And she took the time to actually care about mm-hmm. how we felt about these situations.
Certainly.
So in the bonding of cast members talking about and reading through the script, she really cared about our life experience as well as the experiences that we were going to be portraying. Now, I've done the play before, and I had male directors, and that was not our experience at all.
Interesting.
It was staged as a theatrical production. The blocking and the lighting and the costumes, etc., that was important. With Elizabeth Carter, how we felt was important. What our experience was, what we brought to the table was important. And she took the time to really delve into that. She also, we also were blessed with having an all-female cast of production.
Hmm.
So our lighting designer, our set designer, our costume designer, the sound designers were all extremely skilled artists mm-hmm. in their field. And that was a gift. You don't often get that opportunity in professional theater. Female, highly talented female professionals. So it was really good working with them, putting the production together.
Fantastic. We could spend another, hour talking about the resonance that this work from 1976 now has in this contemporary political
yes.
climate and the world we're in right now.
Yes.
But I imagine a lot of people can draw those parallels when they come see it.
Certainly.
I hope so.
Entozake Shange's work for colored girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough is at the Taube Atrium Theater through the 29th of this month. Information at african-americanshakes.org. Natasha Legrone, thanks so much for coming in as the Lady in Blue, and Jan Hunter, the Lady in Brown. We'll have to talk about Soul Train some other time.
All right, then. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for coming in. African-AmericanShakes.org for more information. That's Open Air for this week. My thanks to producer Neil Swinkles for herding cats today all around the station and for setting up the calendar. If you've got someone you'd like to hear on Open Air featured in the performing arts, by all means, send me an email, david@kalw.org. Our shows are archived at kalw.org, so if you missed a show or want to refer someone to today's program, visit kalw.org. And while you're there, it is our fall membership campaign, the last couple days of which we encourage you to make a donation at kalw.org. Support the arts programming that you hear only on KLW in the way that we present it. News from an international perspective is coming up next from the BBC, another stalwart program here on this station. However you listen to KLW, for the news, for the information, for the culture, for the music, please show your support today. Call 800-525-9917 or make a donation online at kalw.org. One of the runaway hits for thank you gifts was authored by my guest last week, 100 Things to Do in San Francisco Before You Die. That's yours for a $100 gift at kalw.org or when you call 800-525-9917.